Okay, we're back. I'm with Masha, and she's going to start us off with another piece. Want to talk about that for a second?
Okay, I'm going to read the middle section of Reading is a Nightmare, which is broken up into different sections, and I'm going to read 13 and 14. In horror movies or ghost movies, it's clear that reading becomes a plot device, a way to know things in the movie, and to literally get access to the power you need to overcome a beyond human situation. This is especially true in monster movies in which old men who like to read and terrified single women who are being stalked visit an occult friend or an occult bookshop or are shown reading in armchairs with books on werewolves or vampires or both, right before they are about to overcome the monster. Many movies reference the occult, Salem's Lot, Rosemary's Baby, The Exorcist, Don't Look Now, The Evil Dead, Hellraiser, The Omen, Suspiria, and The Howling. In Jaws, sitting with a glass of wine after dinner, sheathed in a fish tank blue, blue light and red wine connect the two main elements in the film, which are blood and water. Roy Scheider looks at old photos of sharks, mostly great whites, attacking various things, boats, people, seals. When he says nobody knows how long they live, the shark enters the realm of the occult. He means nobody knows how to kill these things, nobody knows if they're immortal or how they got started, and by not knowing these things, the shark gets lumped in with the vampires and werewolves of the world. All three bite and require special killing devices. As pseudo-gods that are often difficult to get rid of, celebrities also fit into the supernatural category. The modern meaning of the term celebrity actually derives from the fall of the gods and the rise of the democratic governments in secular societies. Jaws isn't the only thing that Roy can't get rid of. You can't get rid of a lot of things, so I wonder if that makes them part of the occult too. Both the ocean and murder have been around forever. Does that mean you're slipping into spectral territory every time you go for a swim? I watch Jaws at least 3 times a year. I like the weird melancholy effect it has on me. It's both stupid and deep. It doesn't make me afraid of the water, sharks, or politicians. It's very clear on men, and it's the only movie that makes me feel like a bite has been taken out of my life. In Moby Dick, Melville sees the whale as a void and says, "I saw the opening maw of hell." But instead of missing a limb or a cause, part of my memory's been chewed off. I get jealous of the centuries a shark has had at its disposal, all that access to space and time and water and speed, all that privacy. Jaws reminds me of what I love and badly makes me wish for what I would do if it came up again. It's a kind of sand and water and glow that spells red light alert. Over the years, I've read a lot of behind-the-scenes movie trivia about Jaws, accompanied by captioned photos that read, "Woods Hole experts load the shark's head with red paint, squid, and dynamite," and 2,000 watts under seawater. Through reading, I find out that on the Jaws set, things had been going so badly they had given rise to all sorts of rumors that the movie would be called off, that troubleshooters had arrived to straighten the operation out, that the mafia was involved, or that the film would be completed in Hollywood. But all this just makes me love-hate the movie even more. I study pictures of the metal shark's disembodied head and open mouth propped up and operated by an underwater mammoth rig of construction steel covered with rubberized ocean bottom green paint. Both the rigs and the three mechanical sharks came from California. The rig looks like an aquatic roller coaster, again, just like remnants of Pop Pier's amusement park. They called that particular shark the Triple S shark because it stood for Sea Sled Shark. They had to clean its face and reinstall its teeth between takes for all the close-ups, and a little Panaflex camera was used underwater for scenes from the shark's point of view. A compact handheld camera, the Panaflex could fit into anything, even a shark's mouth, and cost $2,400 a week to rent. Jaws may be the first widescreen Panavision movie made with a handheld camera and meant more to the crew than any real person or character in the film. Once, during a third-act scene where the orca boat was supposed to sink, the cameraman, Michael Chapman, panicked and strapped a life jacket to the camera so they wouldn't drown and die. It turns out that it took the crew weeks to load the shark for its death scene, failing over and over to make it look real, that boats like the orca were sunk over and over again. I read that makeup artists use Max Factor spray cans for blood, and that there was a dozen gallon tins filled with red paint and squid labeled Blood and Guts, just like Kathy Acker's novel. Footprints were swept off of sand dunes for each take. Marbles were thrown against the surface of the sea to make it look like bullets were hitting the water in the final crow's nest shootout between Roy and the shark. Hot coffee was poured onto live crabs to get them to move all over Christie's severed arm, and Oak Bluff's harbor was dubbed Shark City. Apparently, Roy felt upstaged by the shark from the beginning, which led to creative differences. After being eaten several times, Robert Shaw needed a film double so he could flee the country for tax evasion from the IRS. A few years before Jaws was filmed in Edgartown, one evening in July, Senator Edward Kennedy swam in between two islands where sharks forage after dark without getting eaten. Originally, Verna Fields, who edited Jaws and introduced George Lucas to Steven Spielberg, was asked to be the producer on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But once Jaws came out, Spielberg got jealous of all the credit she was getting for its success and killed her off in more ways than one. She disappeared from a lot of things, and Jaws is the last movie she ever edited. And when the Bombay press in India asked Julia Phillips, the producer of Close Encounters, Taxi Driver, and The Sting, how Steven Spielberg got the girl in the beginning of Jaws to go this way and that way so violently in the water, judging by the parentheses she puts her answer in You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again, Phillips writes but doesn't say, fearless stuntwoman, 10 men, 10 harnesses, push, pull, lacerations and bruises for years to come, don't ask. Somehow knowing all these things helps me sleep at night. After 10 hours, they made 140 seconds of the movie. I think of money being wasted on so little. The yacht club couldn't get over the huge sums of money spent to make money. 400 people will stampede, chased by a shark, then destroy each other in panic. No wonder they all go nuts in Hollywood. And the people watching do, too.
It's interesting that this piece falls in sort of the middle of this reading as a nightmare story. And it just now I had the spark to ask this question about what you feel like the relationship is between reading and film, and how those two things collide together, if it's possible to come up with something on the fly.
I think that the reading, again, is kind of this active resistance to all the things that you're seeing. So the reading isn't just kind of literal reading of a text. Mm-hmm. It's like the reading of an image. It's the reading of, you know, cinematic narrative. It's the reading of all these kind of things that you're seeing all the time. So there's this popular culture kind of manufactures this overwhelming amount of meaning, and yet what's really happening to it? Where does it all really go? It's like it's all kind of building this surplus of information and meaning, and yet none of it's really being looked at. And so again, I mean, the story is like this critical engagement with the film and this idea that all these kind of gaps are being filled that exist between kind of what we see and how we live and like lived experience and representation. And so by kind of inserting herself into this process of actually reading all of these different things, kind of these answers start to kind of come out. And also this kind of critical resistance starts to happen. And so she has this kind of, you know, ambivalent relationship with the film. And again, it's this relationship which I think the first story sets up, Diegesis, of like what's part of the fiction. And these things that we don't know that are sometimes actively kept out of kind of the cultural imagination, things that they don't want audiences to know, kind of the politics of, you know, actors on a set and how women are treated and like what happens to the woman who gets attacked by the shark, you know, the fact that she kind of went through all this agony to be in this scene that then gets so kind of fetishized and then so kind of cinematically famous, and that that kind of goes into the cultural imaginary. And I didn't want just the kind of official narrative and just the official image to be the thing that everybody's familiar with. It's like really what's actually behind the image, what plays off screen that starts to give like real critical meaning to these, to all these things.
And similar,
so it's like an intervention.
Yeah. It's similar to what Stephanie's talking about. I just was kind of listening, and when you know, with the Kathy Acker Blood and Guts relationship, I suddenly remembered the quote at the beginning of the book about Kathy Acker saying basically it's the 70s now and everything has been swept away.
Into corruption.
Into corruption, yeah. And because you even previously here have talked about that, you know, you're watching films from the 70s because you felt like there was this kind of this weird change happening. I've been watching movies from the 70s.
Yeah.
I've been watching movies from the 70s lately, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore or something. Various movies that like are always somewhat totally not what I expect.
In what way?
It's just, you know, like that movie, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, somehow, like from the get-go, I feel like it's one thing and it just turns or something. Mm-hmm. There's like these, I feel like there's these incredible turns in these movies from the 70s that like me, whatever, looking back, I mean, you know, just something I didn't expect. And maybe it's because Hollywood has gotten better at just doing the formula, but...
That's where all the kind of 80s films become so important, because there's obviously this relationship between kind of 70s new Hollywood cinema, and then kind of the 80s comes over, it comes like and sort of destroys any of that potential that those kind of films were setting up in terms of like viewing and in terms of kind of this disintegration of like dominant ideology. And so I think the reason why the narrative of Jaws is really interesting is because Jaws is really about this kind of repressed thing that comes to the surface. And so using that as a kind of metaphor, like a political metaphor, to try to then look at all the other things that are under the surface. And so then that movie kind of allows me to sort of like start looking into those things.
Yeah.
And then the shark is so kind of feminized too, and these three men on the boat that have to kill her, you know, so these kind of, it's like this allegory. And that film is also just has been, you know, psychoanalyzed in so many different ways. So I just thought it was like this great kind of place to build on.
Yeah, I mean, on those lines, it seems like, at least in your book, like Jaws is it comes up
a lot.
It keeps on rising from the deep in various different places, and it seems like your ambivalence about it is where the real interest when you're talking about Jaws is for the reader and for yourself, and. Can you talk more about, like, not specifically other films, but more about that era of the 70s? These kind of, like, the ambivalence you feel towards certain movies? Because most of the movies you're talking about are from that era, because it's, you know, like, films you saw when you were younger. Or
yeah,
whatever. But
and I was kind of on the cusp of those things. I mean, what's interesting about the kind of 80s films is that Jaws is also the film that kind of changed the culture completely, like the cinematic culture, in terms of it being this first kind of blockbuster film, and had this incredible kind of advertising campaign money that was spent on promoting it. So it's also this kind of interesting like historical moment that happens, and what it actually does to the rest of the kind of cinematic culture, but also to the culture at large in terms of the kind of movies that then really became, like as you were saying, this kind of formula that then was used over and over and over again. And the 70s were at least this attempt at kind of going against the formula and trying to kind of do a narrative that was different. And Jaws kind of just obliterated all that. And so in this weird way, like Jaws is really part of, you know, my childhood. And so I have that kind of weird nostalgia of it being kind of just this surrounding of the landscape and the fact that I spent these summers in Provincetown and kind of the relationship to this sort of like natural landscape. But then that natural landscape is also connected to the kind of cultural landscape, of which is much more problematic than just the nostalgia of a kind of place and what it symbolizes.
Jaws is the one movie there are two movies in that time period that I didn't see that affected me greatly anyway. And Jaws is one, and The Amityville Horror is another. I saw neither as a child, but they terrified me both, right? So swimming in the pool, you'd be like, oh, there's a shark coming. And the image of the poster and the woman swimming and the shark coming up came up as the first grade for me in a way, but I don't want to talk about
that. But you still never seen those films?
I've seen Jaws and
okay.
Amityville Horror much later, you know. I mean, Amityville Horror, I was mad because it tortured me as a child. And but to dip again into the horror and the nightmare of reading, I recently saw a Hammer film. I can't remember the title. It's like Vampires of the 70s or something like this, and the main young buxom lass, Jessica, her grandfather is into the occult, and so she sort of falls into this, and she goes into his library and starts digging up his books, and of course Hammer films are especially in their later incarnations, known for this sort of sexuality of the woman who gets you know, beat
punished.
By the, yeah.
But that's all like that Victorian kind of repression of female sexuality.
Yeah.
And there always being this kind of consequence to that. Which
yeah.
is so much what like Dracula is about in most films.
But it seems like reading can be this entrance into this occult sort of hidden sexuality, and you talk about that in that piece, and I'm hoping you could sort of unpack that a little bit for us here. Sexuality of reading and maybe how it connects to horror a little bit. Or
well, I would think I was, I mean, I don't know sort of what I want to say about that exactly, but just this idea that, again, that the reading becomes a way to kind of reclaim this space of being kind of co-opted. So I think that the reading is like the one way that you, it's like the opposite of being seen. Although there are stories in the book that are very much about like women being seen reading, and that's a kind of image that we're not, isn't as processed, and we're not as used to actually seeing that. So we don't, so it becomes this kind of like break, some kind of break that's not easily assimilated. And so there's like this aspect of reading being incredibly kind of private, and the one thing that you can do on your own that isn't kind of assimilated and isn't being co-opted, because you can kind of figure out what your territory is and you don't have to do it in this kind of visible landscape. And then the other part of it is actually like when you do that in public, then that's kind of, there is this desire to sort of fetishize what you can't like appropriate, what you can't assimilate. So there's that kind of like relationship between those two things of being seen reading, and then also kind of reading being this private pleasure,
yeah.
and kind of radical because of that. Because you're not sharing like the image. When you watch a film, it's like something that you're sharing. And it kind of becomes this communal experience, whereas reading is this, again, this solitary pleasure and this solitary kind of project.
Do you think the books themselves are what teach us how to read in this day of media and books together, or?
What do you mean?
Well, you talked about reading a film. I know this is, you know, common terminology, but I just wonder, you know, where do we learn that? Is it from books? Is it from, it can't be from, you know, any kind of media. They sort of don't want you to learn
yeah,
how to read.
Yeah, so I would say
so.
That, yeah, I'm not sure that we are kind of encouraged. Since we've been talking about the occult. but I think also, just going back to the occult, I think I wanted to also kind of align reading with the occult, because I felt like it gives you this kind of tremendous power. Like, the act of kind of thinking critically gives you this power, so it's this idea that it kind of also becomes, like, supernatural. Because it isn't something that you can appropriate as easily as this kind of a tangible image that everybody kind of collects around. You know, reading is still this thing that's kind of considered very antisocial, and I think also the idea of when women are being seen reading is considered to be this very like antisocial gesture when you're seen reading in public.
There's like a couple sections in here where you kind of have this, or the you, but the character in the book, it has this kind of punk rock fuck you gesture of like, I'm walking down the street and reading. And it's not, I mean, it's, again, I mean, we're talking about it on film, but this is definitely not necessarily on film.
She's not on film.
Yeah. And it kind of connects to this sense of not just being seen reading, but kind of being seen in the world. Although it crystallizes the sense of like being seen as a woman in the world reading, which is, like you've already said, is kind of, you know, unusual, right? Like, we don't know how to process it. But besides being seen on film, like, because this book definitely has a feminist project of kind of, like, unpacking women being seen on film, but there's also this constant project that's not as, although it's not as, like, obvious, I'd say, of unpacking women in the world being seen. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, just this, the idea of we can't really escape the gaze, so can we kind of recuperate some kind of autonomy by doing something that's still seen, but it's not the usual thing that is supposed to be kind of looked at and is supposed to be desired. And so I think I thought it was this really sort of funny image of actually having a woman being in the kind of social landscape and reading. Mm-hmm. I mean, because the two are kind of this absurd like juxtaposition, and actually how provocative that image is, because it's like you're not just available. You're not on the street, kind of walking down the street, being completely available like the screen. There's like something there that you're doing that's almost kind of divorcing you from being just completely available and completely ready to be kind of consumed.
Yeah.
And so it was also about like complicating the image of what, I mean, you can't escape being looked at, but you can kind of complicate what's being looked at. You can kind of, you know, sort of set up a different kind of, you know, image.
It's interesting that the woman, the narrator in the story where the woman is being seen reading, sees another woman reading, and she's in Los Angeles. In my mind, I see her, just, I didn't even think about this till now, but she's walking down Sunset in like the worst West Side of it, just
yeah.
like where it's really
well,
posh.
Well, it's that doppelganger thing again,
yeah.
I think, too. It's this idea of like having this moment of
yeah.
Camaraderie or like communion with another woman who's actually reading.
Yeah.
And then Sunset, obviously, having
yeah.
all this kind of cinematic
right.
Signification.
That's great, yeah.
Well, maybe we should open it up to questions from the audience, if anybody in the audience has any questions. All you have to do is speak up and you'll...
Well, I have a question. Earlier you said that the image in films of the female loner is very rare. And it had never struck me, but that seems to be right. But in the big films, what female loners are there?
Well, I was going to say, my favorite female loner is Juliette Binoche from Kieslowski's Blue. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
Where the whole film is really about how she makes this kind of conscious decision after her husband and her daughter die in the car crash, and she survives, and she has this like survivor's guilt. But she, what's really, was so interesting to me and kind of empowering about that narrative is that it wasn't, she wasn't like immediately then kind of put together with somebody so that that kind of symbolic space would be filled immediately. The whole film was about her kind of active decision to kind of divorce herself and to kind of erase her tracks with the social world. And so it's just this relentless kind of pursuit of her solitude and kind of prioritizing her grief. And because she's prioritizing her grief, she's not immediately trying to look for a way out of it and trying to kind of immediately connect herself with some kind of conventional function. Like, and she's supposed to be somebody else's wife again, or she's immediately supposed to kind of have somebody else come in order to kind of make sure that that gap is immediately filled. So she's, I mean, I think that that's like one of the most memorable examples of that. And the whole film is really the focus of that. And then by extension, it's also about kind of female genius and how her husband had kind of, had been sort of, she'd been composing her husband's music. And then when he dies, she has to sort of go through this process of being alone in order to like reclaim her own artistic identity and to then say that in fact she's been the one that's been composing this music all along. So it's this really kind of amazing exploration of that. But that's definitely something that's really like absent from at least popular films. And then I think Jean Rice's like female kind of loners are amazing, like in Good Morning, Midnight, which I talked about, I reference in the book too. She always has these kind of female loners, but I think that's more obviously more kind of somewhat more common in literature than it is on the screen.
But Blue is decidedly not like Jaws, like doesn't even
no.
hit anywhere the kind of recognition. Is there anything, is there, I mean, I'm not good at thinking of films myself, but
it's,
like are there any big films that have like a
I mean,
know,
I think in horror films it happens, but again, it's like
it's,
this.
Doctors.
Well, I don't even mean that. I mean that like it's usually like these old hags or sorcerers. So like female independence or sort of exile is always then equated with like monstrosity,
yeah.
like in The Exorcist, you know, or whatever. I mean, it always becomes this kind of stand-in for horror. So I think it's this incredibly provocative thing, but it always, you know, gets in some ways like conservatized by the way that the representation is actually dealt with. So I don't really know. I think you see it in horror, but again, it's like these women that have really kind of already gone outside the system and are not going to make their way back anymore. It's like the woman who lives alone on a hill or whatever, you know, and she has like some, it's always interesting because she does have some power, you know, she holds this incredible kind of power, like she knows something about the occult or she's a witch, but she's no longer kind of desirable, you know, she's really just sort of severed from the rest of the world. So she's gone to for like her, for information and for some kind of power that's valuable that someone needs,
yeah.
And that's what I also talk about in that section that I read in Reading as a Nightmare.
I had another question from earlier on, but as we were on the subject of images of women reading, I'm curious about I'm sorry, I haven't read your book.
Okay.
I've read a lot about it, but I haven't read it yet. So I'm only speaking from secondhand experience, but I'm curious about what, when you talk about the image of a woman reading, being empowering, I'm interested in what these women are reading, because in the 19th century, I would say at least half of the classics, not great classic, what have become the canon of literature, are critiques of women reading. I mean, things like Madame Bovary and Anna Karenina, and the basic plot line is that women were reading in mass numbers, and what they were reading was what is derogatorily called romances.
Yeah.
And the what these male so-called avant-garde writers perceived, and what became the Bohemian elite perceived, was that women were taking over a province that was considered to be men, for men,
mm-hmm.
and that women reading was considered to be one of the major problems of the modern, of the rise of modern year. I mean,
yeah.
And I'm not kidding, there's a great deal written about this.
Yeah,
and Madame Bovary is the ultimate example, that if women read, they bring about the downfall of society. well, I mean, locally, around
yeah.
them, and therefore, you know, and it was exactly the same critique that is now made about soap opera. You know, daytime television.
Mm-hmm.
It's been going on for 150 years. So
yeah, they get sucked into this vortex.
Well, it's that they get sucked into wanting something that's beyond reality, that's ideal, and then because they want the supposed critique is that they want something romantic that's more than ideal,
mm-hmm.
and then they demand too much of men. I mean, my critique of that would be is there's a fear of women's demands, and they're blaming reading, the popularization of reading as an activity for women. But the reason I point this out is because in one way, the image of a woman reading in the 19th century was truly powerful. I mean, they were scared shitless.
Mm.
A whole avant-garde was developed to critique that.
Mm.
And there's only one novel that I know of in which a man is criticised for the same behaviour, for becoming too romantic about life through having read. But it's again and again and again, overtly through 19th century literature. So, and it was very powerful and clearly very radical for them to be that afraid, but it's not radical in the same way that you're talking about, because it's something that they openly did. They didn't do it in secret. It wasn't something that women were doing to say, I'm doing a radical gesture. They did it because they wanted to do it. It was men that perceived it as frightening.
Mm.
Whereas you're presenting this image now of women in the 21st century reading as an active gesture of, at least that's what I'm hearing. I don't know if that's what you're actually saying.
So
my question is, what are they reading? Because these 19th century women were just reading because it gave them enormous amounts of pleasure. And I'm not discounting that, but I don't think they saw it as a radical act.
Hmm.
The men saw it as subversive.
But that's, I think, the difference is that these women are actually very much, it isn't just about the pleasure, it's about kind of reading as
an active
resistance. And it has specifically to do, I mean, the difference between the 19th century is that this is specifically a context that's kind of mediated by images. And so it's a different kind of culture entirely, because the kind of notion of the private has really gone, you know, has kind of merged with the public. And this idea of screening everything, right? I mean, it's really just about kind of being seen, and that your status is ultimately kind of defined by how often you're seen, where are you seen, what do other people think about you being seen. And it's like you almost don't exist if you're outside of the image. And so
wait a minute, do you think that, or do you think these women who are reading as acts of resistance think that?
What, in the 19th century or
now?
Now. I don't know what other women feel necessarily about reading, but the characters in the book are specifically sort of dealing with the history of and baggage of female representation specifically. It's not just about kind of, I mean, because in the 19th century we didn't also have this kind of completely media saturated world where lived experience and and representation completely just kind of have fused to the point where representation is really kind of upstaged lived experience. And that relationships between people are really kind of being experienced through images. I mean, I always think that that's like so, when I'm in a grocery store and people start talking about kind of the glossy kind of gossip mags that are on the shelves, you know, in the aisles, and they start talking about these people like they actually know them. I don't know if you've ever experienced that, right? And it's this most, the totally bizarre idea that they're literally their relationships, like real flesh relationships, are being completely mediated by representation and images. And so, I mean, so the context of the reading is very different from why women and how they were reading in the 19th century. I mean, I think that the context really changes that, in my opinion.
Yes, no, that, I recognize that. My question was, what are they reading that is an act of resistance?
I don't think it's so much like what they're reading, it's how they're reading it. I mean, I think that and what I said before, I don't think you can escape the gaze, and I don't think you can escape kind of images and having the landscape completely kind of gentrified by these things. But I think, so what needs to happen is to actually have this critical vigilance of these new kinds of texts, which I think have replaced literary texts, right? People aren't really interested in reading that necessarily. But so the kind of, the text has changed, you know, that's the thing that's kind of, so it's more important to me to have this critical engagement with everything that you're seeing, because that's the only point at which there can be some kind of break and some kind of disruption. Because otherwise there's just this overwhelming amount of meaning and what's happening to it. How is it being dealt with? How is it being recognized? Is it being, you know, thought about really critically, or is it just being consumed? So I'm not that as concerned with like what they're reading. I mean, there are examples of when they're reading something specific, but the text can really be anything. Does that make sense?
Well, I think that the text can be anything is a great way to kind of wrap it up. I like that myself, honestly. But I think you were going to read one last selection. And,
yeah. In which really the virtual is the new text. So it's called Web Life, and I read that because it's short. Well, pretty short. I know you know what I do. I'm always wondering about where you might have seen me. That's the fear. I cover my tracks. You never know. I was on the internet the other day looking at your pictures, studying your face, your hairline, your teeth, your subtle weight gain, worried the whole time that you might discover me there, snooping. My fingers on the keyboard, on your face, coming up to the notes to read them. Sometimes you look horrible. Sometimes you make that face. You've been everywhere, it seems. I'm not really invisible, am I? I wondered, I ask around, people who know these things. Yes, some trace does exist, a number or a code. Yes, but does it point to me? Does the code spell my name? Does it say where I've been? No one says anything. I was shaking like a leaf. It was late. You were probably asleep where you are. It's always 3 hours later where you are. The clock on my computer sometimes stands still, sometimes gets stuck. I just wanted to see what you'd been up to these last 10 years. It's innocent, just checking in. You know how badly it goes in person. How else can I know? I'm not going to call you. We used to run into each other, but found out nothing through our run-ins except that it was all still there. Nothing, I tell you, nothing you'd say back or say first. You already had your projections anyway about what I was, what I am, and unless I ran into you, I'd have no way of knowing anything about you. I looked at all your pictures. You put them there, after all. I guess you want people to see them, but I'd die if you caught me looking at you. Are you looking to catch someone? Do you look to see who's looked? You don't look at your own pictures once you've posted them, do you? This is a great time to be curious. When it comes to you, I've always done things this way. I've always spied and snooped according to the ages, our ages. I type your name and it shows up 100 times in blue. You've done well. Some people only come up once or twice. It's a status thing. I get jealous. It doesn't matter that you're a boy or that we're in completely different fields, worlds. I've been doing it as long as you have. I shouldn't have given you as much support. It's things like my support that got you there, got into your head. I think I deserve better. After I've clicked and looked into it, your name goes purple like I've strangled it. Shit, it's a trace. Old blood restricted, stuck, I am. The purple is a constant documented reminder that I've been there looking for you. My computer registers it and won't let me forget it. I hate myself and pretend like it never happened. I worry anyone could find you, by typing even just the first letter of your name, P. And all the times I'd looked at for you would show up like a grocery list of you, not just you. What if at some point I lost my computer? Like a diary, I'm all over the place in it, and so are all my obsessions and secrets, and so are you. Some obsessions are public, scripted, but most secrets aren't. I have these pictures of you. They're not the ones you posted for everyone's pleasure. They're your pleasure. Since they're not that kind of picture, only the people who know you, including yourself, get the pleasure. I get the creeps, the ones I've always gotten from looking at something that belongs to you. Even when we were together, it felt like we weren't, and I just steal these glimpses, these looks. I just steal from you. Kissing you in your room didn't feel like my fantasy coming to life. It just felt like my fantasy. I felt sick and asked you to stop doing what you were doing. It was shocking how much I'd already imagined. Maybe it ruined everything, actually having you. Hard to stomach that you were really on me, on top, and no longer just in my brain. I get the photos that maybe you don't even know about. I wonder how many people do. I click onto images instead of other kinds of categorical information, like news, groups, maps, or the real biggie, advanced search. I just want to go straight to the face. The web lets me cut to the chase. Do you know that all these people took pictures of you? Were you posing for them at different venues and events? Did you want them to be out there? At one point or another, I think you did. Anyone can see them. Anyone can have them. So why shouldn't I? I doubt anyone asked you if they could take the pictures. If there are lots of people with the same name who have done things to make themselves knowable, a lot of you pops up. But I'm only interested in one of you, one version. I've gotten two things out of being a scopophiliac. I'll make this personal and tell you what I thought of you, or any man I've ever wanted for a long time. First, I wanted you because I spent years looking at your face, really looking at it, or what's now popularly called zooming in. I was little and took to obsession easily. The thing that made me stop wanting you was the same thing that made me start. I looked until I saw your face emitting, until what I didn't like about you anymore showed up on your face, attaching all around it like scaffolding. I didn't know that that's what it was, but I loved how Semitic, Sephardic you looked, how ancient and modern at the same time, a teenager but thousands of years old, like you'd been in a lot of places at once. I thought everything I'd ever wanted was in your face. I spied on you turning your head. I gave up when you started to look so obviously mean. You weren't anything like the boys they made out of corn in the 80s, Silver Spoons, Luke Skywalker, or some other golden consensus. I wish I knew if that affected you the way it affects girls. You were definitely something old in my young body. I went looking for what you decided to publish instead. My pride was with me in all the rooms you'd made. You're so proud of yourself. That's a nice way of putting it. I read everything in your cyber drawer like it was a top secret file. I didn't even have to carefully put it all back afterwards. I listened to the music you'd made, read all your feelings about your latest achievements, your blog, looked at you having fun with all your friends. I felt like such an intruder, a loser. Why are you displaying all the shit that's open for business 24 hours a day? The best department store in the world, all the different levels of you. What's the purpose, the point? After you'd said no to me, who was I to go searching anyway? But I did because that's what it's there for everyone, the whole world, me, to see, even when everyone tells us we're not allowed to. I wasn't allowed to be inside, but I am anyway, because there is more than one way to get there. There is more than just one inside. I want to make sure what I'm not missing. Sometimes in the social sphere of my past, I have to get up close, zoom in to be confident. It's your face that gets rid of any doubt that maybe I should be with you. Your face out in the world says it all. I worried that you, being a microchip wizard, would know exactly who and when and how many times I checked up on you. You'd love that, I worried. Especially after our last correspondence, also on the computer. I panicked that the hour of my search would look the worst, say the most, that not only was I persistent and desperate and an insomniac, but I spent the hours I couldn't sleep perusing around your site. I was looking into you at 4 in the morning. 4 in the morning, that comes across as so crazy. On paper, it's crazy. You wouldn't know the first thing about why I'd do something like that. There'd be nothing to explain it. My porno is my fear of being upstaged by everyone. My porno is how I scan the past and look into it all the time. My face started to burn. I felt nauseous. It was so late. That's when I quickly shut it all down, the site, the computer, you, before you got the chance to realize where I was calling from and trace all of it back to me like Thelma's husband, Daryl, and Thelma and Louise. There are so many yous. A new you is made every day, but you all seem the same. You're all the same when it comes to searching the search engine. What everyone thinks is on the internet too, about you, a relative nobody, about stars and creeps, about a constant glare of bodies, pink and in my face if I want them. I get up so close, not even your friends are there. I'm a dermatologist in your life pores. I'm that obscene. It's obscene. I feel like a pair of fingers squeezing at the facts, the details in your pimples. You had so many when I knew you, but I never let it get in the way of how good your skin really was, really could be once you stopped being so adolescently horny. If I put my mouth to the screen, would I be sucking someone, anyone I choose, fellating them, pleasing myself? Would anything drip out of that bone-dry monitor? You can respond all the time if you want to, and it just stays there on record. Your whims, your spontaneity, your secrets, your stupidity, your total lack of real navigation and bias. Part of me felt happy when I read what everyone thought of what you wrote in that magazine. A whole nest of reaction, mostly bad, when all of what you'd said really wasn't. But it grew every day anyway, warming people up in the circle of feathers. Everything is so light. I shouldn't stare so much and so hard at the screen all day. It weakens my wrist. It weakens a lot of wrists, so how do so many guys beat off all night? I could see I wasn't the only one who doesn't like you, but if it weren't for the future, how would I have ever known that? It's a great time to be unreal. How much of me really exists? How much of me gets stuck like a glitch in the system? I think I can do everything without actually having to show up. I'm pretty sure that's true. How would you find out if I were there? Before the future, I thought I lost everybody. Wouldn't it be great if no one knew me, the whole world at my fingertips? Before, I had no practice for my fears. Now I have some place to put all of them, and this makes it really easy.
Thank you very much. Thank you.